Cthulhu Eats Sesame Street will not be seen tonight, so we may bring you the following eldritch abomination.
That is not dead which can eternal lie, and with strange eons, even death.
Good evening, my lovely deviants, and welcome to the Great Hour of Cthulhu Power. Tonight we will be communing with our great, merciless, and uncaring Lord Cthulhu, who will one day reunite us all in his great big belly after he swallows all of our souls. Unfortunately, that has about a same chance happening as a, 2,000-year-old dead carpenter actually coming back from space. Anyways, welcome to the Flypaper Dungeon podcast. I'm your host, Johnny Zombie, and this week, the long-awaited H.P. Lovecraft episode, or actually, series of episodes. There's no way I could get all of this in 1 hour, so I'm going to do a series of episodes on H.P. Lovecraft. I might break up the episodes with occasional other episodes in between them, just like I'm doing with the Peter Cushing episodes. Now, I'm doing that for two reasons. One, so I don't get bogged down with one topic, and there are other topics I would like to discuss as well that may arise. And two, so that listeners don't feel overwhelmed. There's a lot to cover with H.P. Lovecraft. I've often gotten requests about H.P. Lovecraft, about where people should start, if they are new to H.P. Lovecraft, what books they should buy, what kind of criticism they should read, etc. And so this is going to be a beginner's guide to Lovecraft. This is going to be part one of the Cthulhu mythos. Now, what I've decided to do in order to make Lovecraft more palatable is to split up his fiction into the categories in which it is often categorized. That is, the Cthulhu mythos, the macabre stories, and the dream cycles. Rather than tackle all of it at once in one massive block, which would have been incredibly difficult to do and would have been overwhelming for listeners, I've decided to group it according to those categories. So this is going to be part one of the Cthulhu mythos, which introduces the outer gods, the evil ancient ones, such as Cthulhu, and Dagon, and Narl-Hotep, and Shub-Niggurath, and Yogg-Sothoth, and all the characters, well, creatures and characters, that Lovecraft is best known for. Previously, I have read The Call of Cthulhu and answered it. I read it on October 31st. Duh. I read it on October 31st on Halloween night. Or actually, to be more accurate, that was the Halloween episode, yes, that was released on Halloween night. So listeners can refer to that episode for a reading of The Call of Cthulhu, done by yours truly. For the purposes of this series of episodes, I don't think I'm going to be doing any readings, though I will probably quote from Lovecraft here and there. So I'm going to start this off by having a little bit of a biography of Lovecraft, just to give people some background information as to who he was, and some themes in his fiction. And then I'm going to start talking about his fiction proper. Now, while reading Lovecraft, it's important to note that there's a lot of material to get through. His short stories sometimes read like short novels, and that's partly because they were serialized in magazines like Weird Tales and the like. And so the short stories themselves, like Call of Cthulhu and the Dunwich Horror and At the Mountains of Madness, are almost like short novellas. They're almost like little novels unto themselves, and they are divided into chapters. Now, suffice to say, I'm not going to do an exact chapter breakdown of each and every one, and I'm going to try to do this as spoiler-free as possible, because these episodes are intended for people who have not yet read H.P. Lovecraft. It's intended to kind of sell H.P. Lovecraft to them. So I'm not going to spoil them. I'm going to try my best to give brief synopses of them without actually spoiling anything or giving anything away. Now, it's pretty obvious with a story like Call of Cthulhu that it's about Cthulhu showing up. But when it comes to something like the Dunwich Horror or At the Mountains of Madness, it's not so obvious. So I'm going to try my best not to spoil anything, or not spoil too much. If I do feel that I'm going to do a major spoiler, I will issue a spoiler alert and give you a warning as to how many minutes you should click ahead on your iPod wheels or fast forward on the player located on the Flypaper Dungeon website. So, without further ado, H.P. Lovecraft, Part 1, The Cthulhu Mythos, Part 1. Or H.P. Lovecraft and the Cthulhu Cult of Doom, if you will. So, what can we say about Howard Phillips Lovecraft? Well, here's what we can say about him. He was born on August 20th, 1890 at 9 a.m. in Providence, Rhode Island. Died March 15th, 1937, also in Providence, Rhode Island, buried in Swan Point Cemetery in the Phillips family plot. In other words, the plot of his maternal side of the family, his mother's side of the family. Parents Winfield Scott Lovecraft and Sarah Susan Phillips Lovecraft. Now, Lovecraft was born into a family that came from old wealth, old money. They could trace their family tree way back to the beginning of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. In fact, I found a family tree for the Lovecraft family online, and it is quite extensive. It begins around 1621 or so, if I'm not mistaken. And the tree kind of, well, it basically ends with Lovecraft. He was an only child, and he had no children. Although it's possible that there may have been other people, you know, related to him through his mother's side of the family and his father's side. That family tree that I found basically ends with him. And New England is a culture unto itself. Rhode Island has its own way of life, Massachusetts, Vermont, Maine, etc. New England really is its own subculture in a way, and Lovecraft was very much a part of that. Now, Lovecraft's father, Winfield, was a traveling salesman for a metallurgist, a silversmithing company. His father contracted syphilis, and in a hotel room in Chicago, he became acutely psychotic. He began having delusions, etc., and was soon afterwards diagnosed with paresis, which is a form of mental illness associated with syphilis. This is the same condition that led to the death of Al Capone. And ironically enough, Lovecraft was born 9 years before Capone, which I found kind of interesting. Just a little bit of trivia there that I uncovered. So his father died in 1898, when Lovecraft was just an 8-year-old boy. Now, years later, his own mother was to be diagnosed with a form of mental illness, possibly schizophrenia. She died in 1919 after routine gallbladder surgery, and she died in the same mental institution as his father, Butler Hospital. Now, Lovecraft was a very precocious child. He read a lot. He was largely self-taught. He did not attend school until age 8, because he was somewhat of a temperamental child, and basically had no patience for fools, pretty much. So he was largely self-taught, and he never graduated high school. This is blamed partly due to an emotional breakdown, which happened around the time that Lovecraft's family began to suffer financial hardship, mostly caused by the death of his grandfather. Lovecraft was very close to his maternal grandfather, Wibble Van Buren Phillips, who was a noted industrialist in Providence. He owned a textile factory, if I'm not mistaken. And so the Lovecraft family and the Phillips family were both well-to-do until these financial hardships occurred, until Van Buren passed away. Due to mismanagement and, well, various other causes, the Lovecraft family fortune began to dwindle. And so Lovecraft and his two aunts and his mother were pretty much destitute. By this point, his mom had already been committed to a mental institution, and so Lovecraft was living with his aunts Lillian, and let me check my notes here. Annie and Lillian, yes, his aunts Annie and Lillian, who were from his mother's side of the family. And they were quite elderly, they were much older than him, and he lived with them, pretty much until his death. I believe his Aunt Annie was the surviving aunt that actually survived him, and she passed away not too long after that. Lovecraft only lived to be about 46 years old, and the main bulk of his literary work is within the last 16 years of his life. Prior to that, he wrote a lot of poetry as a child, and he was influenced by the tales of Lord Dunsany, a very famous British fantasy author, who wrote kind of dark fantasy stories. He was also influenced by Algernon Blackwood, another famous gothic horror writer, and by Arthur Machen. He was also influenced by the pulp magazines that he had written during his life, or written for during his lifetime, and he was also greatly influenced by Edgar Allan Poe. Although, the more Lovecraft you read, the more you realize there was a great difference between him and Poe. Poe is more centered on the human psychological aspects of it, whereas Lovecraft is more or less focused upon the warping of reality, the twisting and bending of reality, and the hidden sort of horror that's hidden underneath the reality in which we live. Now, Lovecraft did marry during his lifetime, but he had a very brief marriage. It lasted only about 2 years, to a woman named Sonia Green, who herself was a Russian immigrant, and her life story is quite interesting as well. She was a hat shop owner, a small businesswoman, at a time when it was very unusual for women to own businesses. Lovecraft's aunts did not approve of the fact that their nephew married a businesswoman, a quote-unquote tradeswoman, as they pointed it. They felt that a blue blood like him should have married some independently wealthy woman instead of a self-made woman. Not to mention, she was also an immigrant. So, some scholars believe that that's part of the reason why the marriage had ended so quickly. And it was due to other factors. There were financial hardships. They lived in New York very briefly, in a very rough part of town called Red Hook. Sonia had gone to Ohio to try and, you know, recoup her business because she had lost her business in New York. And at one point, she considered moving back to Providence to be with Lovecraft, and then due to pressure from his aunts, Lovecraft kind of caved, and the marriage wound up ending. Some people cite the fact that Lovecraft's wife was Jewish, but that had nothing really to do with it. He accepted her, and it's been proven that her religion or her ethnicity had nothing to do with it whatsoever. And I'll talk about Lovecraft and race in a little bit. That's a contentious issue for some, but it does need to be addressed. And it needs to be explained that Lovecraft, while there was some racism in some of his early fiction, as time went on and he wound up meeting other people and traveling to other places, it begins to thin out. So as he matured, the racism pretty much kind of disappears. And after a while, it's not even there at all. So he did learn to be tolerant as he had gotten older, but that's something I'll get to in a little bit. Now, Lovecraft, again, as I had said, had no children. He lived to be 46 years old and was an only child. And a lot of people often mistakenly believe that he was a hermit, that he led a reclusive existence. As it turns out, not really. He actually traveled quite extensively. He traveled to Quebec, Canada. He traveled to Florida, to St. Augustine. He traveled all over the eastern seaboard, pretty much. And he did live in New York for a very brief period of time in his life. Lovecraft lived at a time when the world was changing, when the old guard was falling away. his old money was no longer enough, and now we had industrialists like Andrew Carnegie coming on the scene and becoming quite independently wealthy. You know, Carnegie came to this country with absolutely nothing and became a steel baron. And so we saw the Industrial Revolution happen during his own lifetime, well, pretty much the latter days of the Industrial Revolution by the 1890s. We saw things like women getting the right to vote. We saw the rise of the Jazz Age. We saw women having access to education. Society was changing at this time, and it scared a lot of people. Lovecraft's fear of the unknown was very much at play. And so, before I get on to his fiction, I'm going to address the elephant in the room, which is Lovecraft and race. And this is from the introduction written by Robert Bloch to the Best of H.P. Lovecraft, Blood-Curdling Tales of Horror and the Macabre, which was the first Lovecraft book that I bought. And Robert Bloch, famously, was the author of Psycho, the original novel that spawned the Alfred Hitchcock classic. And he was a correspondent with H.P. Lovecraft and was greatly influenced by him. And I sometimes wonder if there's a little bit of Norman Bates, or a little bit of Lovecraft, I should say, in the character of Norman Bates, because of the contentious relationship with the mother and the absence of the father and so on. But that's just speculation on my part. I wouldn't print that as gospel. So this is from Robert Bloch's intro. If Lovecraft was a racist, we must recognize that the term was not generally considered pejorative during his own time. In the 20s and 30s, Anglo-Saxon superiority was virtually taken for granted, not only in literature, but in daily life. And nowhere was this belief more pronounced than in New England. Here the DAR, Daughters of American Revolution, held sway, and the inhabitants of the self-styled Shrine of Liberty shuddered as their communities were invaded by immigrants, ignoring the fact that most of these foreigners had been imported by blue-blooded 100% Americans to provide cheap labor for their factories. They watched in dismay as cities became crowded, old landmarks gave way to new construction, and their political, economic, and social control gradually vanished. To Lovecraft, these changes were anathema, and he expressed his attitude both privately and in print. But his views were not inflexible. As he matured, he gradually came out of his shell, and his outlook broadened. The racist element of earlier efforts is muted or absent in later tales. And what sort of anti-Semitic author marries a Jewess, associates with Jews as friends, and corresponds and retains one, has his literary agent? The one theme incontrovertibly constant in both his life and his work is a preoccupation with dreams. And in fact, Lovecraft was largely influenced by nightmares that he had and night terrors, as was Rod Serling, creator of The Twilight Zone. So, now that the elephant in the room is addressed, we can move on and we can discuss Lovecraft's fiction. So his fiction is divided into three segments. Now these are segments that he himself did not divide them into, but his fans did years later. And that is the Cthulhu mythos, stories revolving around Cthulhu and the ancient ones, these elder malevolent gods from alien worlds and alternate dimensions. The dream cycle, which is a series of basically nightmare landscapes, and the character of Randolph Carter, who many believe is a sort of literary avatar for H.P. Lovecraft. And then we have the macabre tales, which are basic horror stories like Herbert West's Reanimator and so forth, stories that are very much just basically little fright fests, but aren't connected to a much larger body of work. So, the Cthulhu mythos is probably the best known of his works simply because of the character of Cthulhu and the influence the Cthulhu mythos has had on a much broader scale, on society and on culture in general. It permeates pretty much anywhere and everywhere you look in terms of horror. Lovecraft began writing for the pulp magazines when he was reading a magazine called The Argosy, which was a very famous magazine back in the day. They pretty much started pulp. And he wrote a letter to them complaining about love stories and how, you know, bland they were and ridiculous. And so he started writing for the basically independent press, the Amateur Press Association. And he was involved very much in amateur journalism, which is where he met his wife, Sonia. And so he began publishing in Weird Tales in 1923. And from that point on, he was to be forever associated with that magazine. Now, through writing with Weird Tales, he met Robert Bloch, Clark Ashton Smith, who was a famous writer and sculptor. He sculpted a lot of eldritch abomination-type creatures. And Robert E. Howard, creator of Conan the Barbarian, Solomon Kane, and lots of other literary badasses. So it's through this magazine that Lovecraft corresponded with this large circle of friends and circle of correspondents, some of whom he knew in real life, and some of whom he only corresponded with and never actually met in person. One of whom was Harry Houdini. In fact, Lovecraft ghost wrote a piece for him called Under the Pyramids, also known as Imprisoned with the Pharaohs, in the edition that I have, which is called The Road to Madness. It is called Imprisoned with the Pharaohs. Houdini, who I might also add was Jewish, also contacted Lovecraft about writing a book on skepticism. As we know, Harry Houdini was a very famous skeptic. He exposed psychic mediums and such. And so he wanted to work with Lovecraft on a much longer book about skepticism. Unfortunately, this book was not to come because Houdini had passed away. On Halloween night, I might add. Now, in terms of Lovecraft's religious background, he was an atheist. He was an avowed atheist, and we see this very much prevalent in his fiction, in what is called cosmic horror, or cosmicism, which is a phrase Lovecraft himself had coined. In fact, I'm going to read from the website, as Chinstroker vs. Punter calls it. The website, for those of you who don't know, is Wikipedia. And granted, Wikipedia is not perfect, but sometimes it can help you in a clinch. Most of the material that I'm using here, mostly biographical material, came from both Bloch's introduction and from the introductions to the other editions I have of Lovecraft's fiction. And I will admit, some of it did come from Wikipedia, and some of it came from an essay by S.T. Joshi, who is considered the foremost Lovecraftian scholar, and who wrote a quite highly praised biography of Lovecraft called H.P. Lovecraft, A Life. Now, cosmicism, reading from the website here, as a literary philosophy developed and used by the American writer H.P. Lovecraft in his weird fiction. Lovecraft was a writer of philosophically intense horror stories that involve occult phenomena like astral possession and alien miscegenation, and the themes of his fiction over time contributed to the development of this philosophy. Philosophy of cosmicism states that there is no recognizable divine presence, such as a god in the universe, that humans are particularly insignificant in the larger scheme of intergalactic existence, and perhaps are just a small species projecting their own mental idolatries onto the vast cosmos, ever susceptible to being wiped from existence at any moment. This also suggested that the majority of undiscerning humanity are creatures with the same insignificance as insects, in a much greater struggle between greater forces which, due to humanity's small, visionless, and unimportant nature, it does not recognize. In other words, we are lost and alone in the universe. There is no signpost up ahead. There is no divine influence that guides my destiny, Han Solo. We're in this on our own. There's no benevolent force that's going to help us. It's us versus the universe. The universe doesn't know, doesn't care, doesn't give a great goddamn whether you live or die or even exist. You are just here. You evolved from a lesser life form and became a human being, and there is no god that's going to guide you in your life, or that is responsible for your creation or your development. You're on your own, kid. It shares a lot of principles in common with nihilism. And while some people might consider this to be a very negative philosophy, I think of it as a very positive philosophy, because it suggests that there is no such thing as fate, there is no such thing as demons or devils or angels or gods. It's up to us to make this world what it is. You know, this very much does line up with a very sound, very rational philosophy when it comes to writing fiction and when it comes to a view of the universe. Now, the article goes on, now that's my commentary right there, but going back to the article here, it goes on to say, Lovecraft's cosmicism was a result of his complete disdain for all things religious. His feeling of humanity's existential helplessness in the face of what he called the infinite spaces, opened up by scientific thought, and his belief that humanity was fundamentally at the mercy of the vastness and emptiness of the cosmos. In other words, a giant rock hits the earth, we're screwed. You know, the hand of God's not going to help you. If nature decides we should die off like the dinosaurs, we should die off like the dinosaurs. There's frack all you can do to stop it. In his fictional works, these ideas are often explored humorously. Herbert West, Reanimator, which is, well, you know, Herbert West making a bunch of zombies. Through fantastic dreamlike narratives, Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, or through his well-known Cthulhu mythos. Common themes related to cosmicism and Lovecraft's fiction are the insignificance of humanity in the universe and the search for knowledge ending in disaster. In other words, anytime somebody reads the Necronomicon, bad stuff happens to them and to the people around them. And in the case of Herbert West, he's trying to cure death like it were a disease, because West is a doctor, like Dr. Frankenstein. And much like Frankenstein, he, well, I don't say tampers in God's domain, because according to Lovecraft, there is no God. He just basically messed with the natural flow of things, and, well, chaos ensues. Or in the case of Call of Cthulhu, you have a malevolent god. And some commentary I'd like to add to that is that, to me, Cthulhu is very much a spoof of organized religion and of God in general. The Cthulhu cult is, it's very much its own primitive religion as it is a spoof on organized religion. In other words, it's elements of all religions basically jammed together. You have a group of worshippers who beat drums and chant and dance and worship an idol of Cthulhu. And then in churches you have statues of saints and Christ and so on. And then other religions you have statues of gods. How is Cthulhu any different? You have this malevolent creature who these worshippers desperately believe in. They greatly believe in Cthulhu. And they believe that when the stars are right, Cthulhu will return. Just as Christians believe one day Christ will return. Cthulhu rises from the ocean, and he begins munching on people like, well, human Rice Krispies treats. Cthulhu swallows their souls, and he is nourished by their souls. The believers in the Cthulhu cult really want to be eaten. In fact, there's a common saying among Lovecraftians, and that is, may he eat you first. Meaning, may Cthulhu eat you first. May you be worthy enough to be a sacrifice for Cthulhu. And then in Christianity, of course, we have Christians considering themselves to be a living sacrifice. We have Christ considered to be a sacrifice for the sins of humanity. In the case of Cthulhu, he's just this bloated overlord that swallows people's souls. Cthulhu is this massive eater who just eats and eats and eats and eats and eats until he is satisfied and the world is left in devastation. That's assuming that the other ancient ones haven't gotten there first. So, you have followers that want to die, that want to be eaten by Cthulhu. And we see that in cults in real life. People that willingly commit suicide, like in the Jim Jones cult. And then, of course, in the early days of Christianity, we had Christians being fed to lions. And it's often been speculated that early Christians lusted after death as a form of martyrdom, believing that they would be given entree into heaven. And of course, we have a situation now in which we have suicide bombers detonating themselves, willfully believing that they will have entree into a form of heaven. And so we have a massive very rich tapestry of these sort of bizarro religions that we've all been chasing our entire lives and that have been with us since the dawn of time. And Lovecraft is commenting on them. He's kind of spoofing them in a way. For me, satire is when you make fun of something, but you're not being funny. You're being serious. And that, to me, is what Cthulhu is. He's a satire on religious excess and on a belief in a malevolent god. Because if you really think about it, even the god that we're taught to follow, like in Christianity or the god of the Bible, is really a malevolent force. It's a force that will grant favors based upon worship of that god, but then anybody who disagrees with that god or steps out of line is severely punished. In some cases, God wipes out entire societies. Cthulhu will wipe out entire societies, in fact, all of human society. He just doesn't give a damn. He wants to swallow us whole, and when he's done, he's going to move on. He came here from an ancient world, from a place called Vorl, which is several light years away from Earth, and he was imprisoned by the elder gods, these gods that were benevolent, that fought against Cthulhu and his kind, and Cthulhu was imprisoned under the ocean in the city of Relier, which was then sunk, and so he rests in a sepulcher. Cthulhu lies dead dreaming, as the saying goes, though technically he's not dead, he's more or less asleep. And in the Call of Cthulhu, once Cthulhu rises, he is not defeated, he's still out there. Imagine how terrifying that would be if you were a kid reading the story, you know, that there's this malevolent god that's still out there, lurking, that cannot be defeated. He can be put to bed, but he can't be killed. The Ghostbusters were able to defeat him. They didn't kill him, but they sent him away. In their story, the Collect Call of Cthulhu, which I'll get to in a moment about the influence of H.P. Lovecraft. Now, getting back to the bio portion of Lovecraft, Lovecraft only lived to be 46 years old. He died from a combination of intestinal cancer, Bright's disease, which is a form of nephritis, inflammation of the kidneys, and apparently a form of kidney stone as well. And it also results in blood in the urine. I couldn't even read the whole article. It was really gross. Yeah, so in other words, it's a nasty way to go. And he was also suffering from malnutrition. I recently found out what Lovecraft's diet was, and it consisted of red meat, beans. He was a big fan of Hershey's chocolate. Yay, Pennsylvania. And he was also a big fan of cheese, apparently. And as soon as I began reading the various items in his diet, I realized that I share a very similar diet. And I should probably change it. So, yeah. Lovecraft ate a very Spartan diet. And, not a vegetarian, definitely. It's there in his letters as to what he had eaten, and it apparently wasn't very healthy. So some writers speculate that that may have been part of what led to his premature demise, which is a reminder to me to eat my greens. Now, when he died in 1937, he was buried in the Phillips family plot, and his name was inscribed upon the tombstone with his parents. In 1977, a group of fans pitched in and bought Lovecraft his own tombstone, which is inscribed with his name, his birth date, and his death date, and the phrase, "I am Providence," which was taken from a letter Lovecraft had written. Some speculate that "I am Providence" means "I am the divine hand of God," etc., but most likely it had to do with the fact that Lovecraft was born in Providence, Rhode Island, and was very proud of his hometown. And so this was in honor of Lovecraft and his hometown of Providence, Rhode Island. Now, it's of interest to note that Lovecraft never officially filed for divorce from his wife, Sonia Green. He signed his name on the paper, as did Sonia, but he never took it to the courthouse. This wasn't discovered until after Lovecraft's death. In fact, his ex-wife didn't realize that Lovecraft was even dead until about 18 months after his actual passing. After that point, she had already remarried, and she discovered that Lovecraft had not officially filed the divorce papers, meaning her marriage was bigamous. I don't know if that was revenge from beyond the grave on Lovecraft's part, or if it was to avoid alimony payments, or if he simply was absent-minded and didn't file it. So, eventually, you know, she was technically divorced from him because Lovecraft had passed away. She also had a daughter, as a matter of fact, and Sonia Green did write a biography on Lovecraft. And I believe that was simply titled H.P. Lovecraft, A Life. And Sonia passed away in the 1970s. And her life story was quite interesting as well. Just to take a detour here, her first husband died apparently of a suicide. A very, very unusual death. I believe her second marriage also ended in divorce. She was the daughter of Ukrainian immigrants and was a self-made woman, and basically worked in women's fashion for pretty much the rest of her life. Quite an unusual story, and quite a fascinating one, almost as unusual as the bio of Lovecraft himself. So after Lovecraft's death, his work was effectively ended. A story called In the Walls of Eryx, which he had co-written with another author, and let me see if I can find who that author's name was. Kenneth Sterling. That was the author's name. I just grabbed my copy of The Transition of H.P. Lovecraft. Yes, Kenneth Sterling was the author's name that he co-wrote In the Walls of Eryx with. And that was the first and only time that a Lovecraft story was featured on the cover of Weird Tales magazine. Even though we often associate him with that magazine, they didn't, for some reason or other, feature him on the cover before. So, effectively, Lovecraft was pretty much gone at this point. His writing was no longer in print until August Derleth and Donald Wandrady brought his work back into print under their own publishing house, Arkham House Publishing. They've since gone on to publish other authors. August Derleth also contributed episodes to Rod Serling's The Night Gallery, and very Lovecraftian type writing that Derleth committed himself to. He also took some of Lovecraft's unfinished pieces and finished them, and this is where the controversy lies in August Derleth, because he kind of claimed ownership of a lot of Lovecraft's work as a result of bringing it back into print. And so there's been a dispute ever since then about who really owns Lovecraft's work. The majority of it is pretty much in the public domain at this point, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's all in the public domain. In fact, according to the article here, Lovecraft proteges and part owners of Arkham House, August Derleth and Donald Wandrady, often claimed copyrights over Lovecraft's work. On October 19, 1947, Derleth purchased all rights to Weird Tales. However, since April 1926 at the latest, Lovecraft had reserved all second printing rights to stories published in Weird Tales. Hence, Weird Tales may only have owned the rights to at most six of Lovecraft's tales. Again, even if Derleth did obtain the copyrights to Lovecraft's tales, no evidence has yet been found that the copyrights were renewed. And so, there's been a dispute about this. Searches at the Library of Congress have failed to find any evidence that these copyrights were renewed after the 28-year period, and hence it is likely that these works are now in the public domain. And so, this is why we have Cthulhu everywhere. Cthulhu t-shirts, video games, toys, books, Chibi-Thulus, underwear, you name it. Anybody who wants to can write a Lovecraft pastiche and can do a Cthulhu story, because Cthulhu's a public domain character. And quoting again from Der Wikipedia, regardless of the legal disagreements surrounding Lovecraft's works, Lovecraft himself was extremely generous with his own works and actively encouraged others to borrow ideas from his stories, particularly with regard to his Cthulhu mythos. He actively encouraged other writers to reference his creations, such as the Necronomicon, Cthulhu, Yog-Sothoth. After his death, many writers have contributed stories and enriched the shared mythology of the Cthulhu mythos, as well as making numerous references to his work. Blah. There we go. So, who are these numerous authors that have expanded upon his work and were influenced by him? Well, funny you should ask. In the 1960s, there was a revival of Lovecraft. A lot of college students, a lot of college kids began to become fans of his work and really hook onto him. one of whom was Stephen King. Another was Clive Barker. Neil Gaiman, Barbara Hambly, of course Robert Bloch, all emulated Lovecraft and were all fans of his work. In the 1960s, we saw this new wave of horror coming up. Of course, George A. Romero with Night of the Living Dead in 1968. Horror was now getting, well, going back to being this dark, cosmic, brutal horror again. Stephen King has even gone on to say, and I'm quoting directly from the man himself here, "The 20th century's greatest practitioner of the classic horror tale." And he has even gone on to say that Lovecraft influenced him greatly, and that basically began his fascination with horror and the macabre. You never forget your first, Steve. Neil Gaiman is also greatly influenced by H.P. Lovecraft, and in fact, one of the books I have, The Dream Cycle of H.P. Lovecraft, has an intro by Neil Gaiman, or as I like to call him, Huggy Bear. And then, of course, there's a blurb here from Clive Barker. "Lovecraft's fiction is one of the cornerstones of modern horror. These dream stories are a perfect introduction to his work, a unique and visionary world of wonder, terror, and delirium." He has also influenced the great John Carpenter, who has said, "A master craftsman, Lovecraft brings compelling visions of nightmarish fear, invisible worlds, and the demons of the unconscious. If one author truly represents the very best in American literary horror, it is H.P. Lovecraft." And Carpenter himself made a film that emulated Lovecraft and was basically pretty much a Valentine to Lovecraft, called At the Mouth of Madness, in which, well, strange doings are going on in a small New England town revolving around a writer named Sutter Kane. And it's incredibly Lovecraftian. It makes several references to Lovecraft, so much, in fact, that many of the illustrations on the Sutter Kane novels are illustrations of Eldritch Abominations. Lovecraft's influence is immense. There are more writers than you can count that have been influenced by H.P. Lovecraft, and I'm going to go so far as to say that he is the father of modern horror. Even though in his own lifetime he never became a massive celebrity, he certainly is one in death. He went on to not only influence Stephen King and Anne Rice and Clive Barker and Neil Gaiman and John Carpenter and Tobe Hooper and Dan O'Bannon, the creator of Alien, and Stuart Gordon, who did his own Reanimator film, although not exactly based on Lovecraft. It took many, many liberties. Still, he's adapted Lovecraft several times, and Dan O'Bannon himself adapted From the Beyond into a film, a rather faithful retelling of The Beyond. His influence is widespread. It's everywhere, pretty much. All you have to do is go to Arkham Bazaar. Bazaar being like a Moroccan bazaar, being spelled B-A-Z-A-A-R. In fact, I should post a link to it. You can go there and see all kinds of Lovecraftian merchandise. They even sponsor an H.P. Lovecraft film festival. And of course, Guillermo del Toro recently tried to make At the Mountains of Madness into a film. Lovecraft's work has been made into films several times, although usually not very accurately. His work is considered somewhat unfilmable and very, very difficult to adapt, and so it's been influencing many horror writers over the years. And many horror filmmakers in their writing, but not so much in adaptations of his work. But at the same time, his influence is massive and cannot be denied. It pretty much permeates every level of culture at this point. In fact, I'm very surprised there isn't a statue of him in Providence, Rhode Island, although I imagine somebody is probably planning to do that. And I wouldn't be too surprised if at some point, you know, Cthulhu winds up on a postage stamp. I would love to see Lovecraft on a postage stamp. I'm surprised that hasn't happened yet either. So, some common elements of Lovecraft's fiction. Little things that happen here and there. We have these cosmic elder gods who are malevolent and destructive. They are a force for evil. We have human beings battling against cosmic forces. We have the sort of unknown horror world hidden beneath our own. In some cases, quite literally, like in The Rats in the Walls, there's literally a subterranean world of all kinds of vile ickiness. We have human beings who are bizarrely mutated, or in the case of Arthur German, a human being who is an alien-human hybrid. Spoiler alert on that one, sorry. Well, it's kind of obvious. Miscegenation, again. We have the fictitious Miskatonic University, located in the equally fictitious Arkham, Massachusetts, located on the banks of the also fictitious Miskatonic River, which cuts a massive swath right through Massachusetts. And many of the fictional towns that Lovecraft writes about are located on the banks of the Miskatonic. In fact, some real towns like Salem are also located on the Miskatonic in Lovecraft's fiction. And Miskatonic U is basically a university on par with Harvard. It was based loosely on Bradford College, which since 2000 is defunct. I'm very sad to know that because I could have gone to Miskatonic. Damn it! Which is located on the Merrimack River in Havermill, Massachusetts, or excuse me, Haverhill, Massachusetts, which is a real town. It was a mill town in Massachusetts, and apparently it was very, in Lovecraft's time, it was very much a class-conscious town. You had the haves and the have-nots in that town. Now, it's interesting to note that Haverhill is the hometown of Rob Zombie. A little bit of trivia there for you. Miskatonic University appears in a lot of Lovecraft's fiction, particularly in the Cthulhu mythos, and basically was the norm in Lovecraft's time. Most of the faculty and the student body is male, except for a woman named Asenath White in the Lovecraft story The Thing on the Doorstep. And Miskatonic also has a medical school. So basically, it's on par with a university like Harvard or Yale, etc. Any of the northeastern colleges, it just so happens to have a copy of the Necronomicon. That infamous, vile book written by the mad Arab Abdul al-Hazred. And I've talked about the Necronomicon extensively in my episode about the Necronomicon. And this goes to show you even more influence from Lovecraft. The Necronomicon is the MacGuffin in the Evil Dead trilogy. So, more Lovecraftian influence on film and elsewhere. In fact, there are some people who believe the Necronomicon is real, and Lovecraft spent a fair amount of time dispelling these rumors and basically trying to convince people that no, he just made it up, and in reality, he did just make it up. It does not actually exist. But several hoax editions exist, and people like to pretend that it is real, and they like to freak people out with it, but there's no truth to it. It's completely fictitious. So that's a basic overview of Lovecraft's work and of the life of H.P. Lovecraft. So that is a starting point, a good starting point. Call this a mini-lecture, if you will, a very informal lecture, taken from very few notes, but taken from quite a bit of reading. So, I am probably going to end this episode here, seeing as how I'm almost at the hour mark, about 10 minutes in before the hour. So I'm going to end this episode right here. I expected to take about 10 minutes talking about H.P. Lovecraft and then move on to something else, move on to his fiction in the Cthulhu mythos. But the best laid plans of mice and elder gods. So, next week, I'm going to start talking about the Cthulhu mythos. I feel it's best if I wait until next week to actually do a full episode on the mythos, or at least a part one of it, because if I start doing it now, this episode's going to run a bit longer than an hour, and I could easily be here for a good 90 minutes up to 2 hours. And some of you may enjoy that, but I don't want to overwhelm anyone or beat them over the head with Lovecraft. I will make you love Lovecraft! Instead, I want them to willingly come to the cult of Cthulhu and want to be eaten by Cthulhu. So next week, I'm going to come back with some more H.P. Lovecraft, and we'll talk about the mythos proper. So, I'm going to end this episode with a thank you, a huge, huge thank you to all who have listened to this episode. Please please send any comments to flypaperdungeon@gmail.com. That is my email address. The website address for this podcast is www.flypaperdungeon.blogspot.com. We also have an official Facebook group where you can interact with us. And we have an RSS feed you can subscribe to on the Flypaper Dungeon website, so you'll get new episodes sent to you via RSS feed and be updated when there are new developments on the site. This is an episode that was a long time coming, and I hope I've done some justice to the life and work of H.P. Lovecraft. By no means is this a definitive guide to Lovecraft, nor is it meant to be. It's just meant to be a starting point, and meant to answer some questions, and it's probably raised a lot of questions as well. So if anybody has any questions, email me or comment in the comment box on the website, and we'll try and find an answer. If there is an answer. If not, then I don't know, I'll just make something up. Anyways, that's it for the Life of H.P. Lovecraft. Next week, the Cthulhu Mythos proper. So, I will talk to you then. This is Johnny Zombie, over and out. May he eat your soul first, Cthulhu Fatagan, and remember, Cthulhu loves you. And we do too. Bye-bye for now. Oh. I can't leave without saying this. Probably the best-known quote from H.P. Lovecraft. And this pretty much says it all. This quote makes good horror. This explains what makes good horror, and why H.P. Lovecraft is still with us today, why his writing is so influential, and why crap like Hostel will never compare to the awesomeness that is Lovecraft. Here it is. This is the core of all horror. This is it. This is what makes for good horror. Here's the quote. The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown. Think about that. Remember that. We will comment on it next week as the Lovecraftian Love Fest continues. The Lovecraftian Lectures on the Flypaper Dungeon. Johnny Zombie over and out for real this time. Cthulhu Fatagan.